Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to an episode of Elevate the Future Podcast. If you think that kids are waiting for the adults to get it together, you better listen up. A variety of hosts will moderate conversations to provide young students with the resources to realize their passions early and apply them in their community. We can and must create a world where students worldwide have access to quality education in business and computer science. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Elevate the Future Podcast, a deep dive into startups, emerging technology, and the future. I'm Ellen Xu, your host, and today I'm here with Kino Fisher, co-founder of Julia Computing and one of the core members in implementing the Julia Computing language. At the age of 25, Fisher was selected by Forbes 30 Under 30 in Enterprise Technology for his work with Julia Computing, which is one of the fastest modern open source language for data science, machine learning, and scientific computing. It has been downloaded over 2 million times and has taught at MIT, Stanford, and in over 100 universities around the world. So welcome, Mr. Fisher.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, so your work with Julia is obviously very phenomenal. Could you tell me first a little bit more about Julia, what it is and how you were able to get into its creation?
Yeah, absolutely. So Julia is a programming language. And what you tend to run into with those languages is that there is a bit of a tension between the usability of a programming language, how easy it is to get something done, and the performance of the code that you end up writing. So how fast will it run? And performance can also impact the kinds of applications that you can have, because you know, if something is 100 times slower, then you know, you can only do problems that are 100 times smaller than the largest possible program you can do given the hardware available. So the idea behind Julia was to try to create a language that has both the performance and the usability, you know, maximized at the same time. Obviously, there's some trade-off, but, you know, hopefully we are able to find a trade-off in such a way that there's no need to have two languages to get both productivity and performance. So there's this thing called the two-language problem, because what people tended to do was that they would pick one usable language and one fast language, and then put them together. But you end up with all sorts of problems just interfacing two different languages.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense too, not really having to implement two languages. So how did you get into its creation?
Julia itself started as a research project at MIT. So that started in sort of late 2009, although most of the development sort of early 2010, 2011. And then it was announced to the public in 2012 in February, and I was in high school at the time. So I had at that point competed in a competition in mathematical modeling. So the mathematical competition in modeling, there's a high school version and a college version, and at the time, I was enrolled in the EPGY program at Stanford for some online high school classes that my local high school did not offer. And as part of that program, we participated in these mathematical modeling competitions. So I was exposed to, you know, mathematical modeling and sort of mathematical programming, scientific programming, because you know, it's sort of a different set of there's a set of programming techniques for modeling the physical world, right? And and what you do in physical modeling differs quite a bit from, say, you know, writing a web server or writing an app, right? So, but this mathematical computation and modeling was sort of the first, my first exposure to, you know, modeling as a programming task. And I did it in Octave, and Octave is a very slow language. It's one of those languages that are designed for usability. And it's, you know, it's okay at that, you know, now that I have some opinions on programming language design, you know, it's not great, but you know, it's decent. You know, you can get your things done, but it's very slow. Mm-hmm. And the thing about the mathematical computation modeling is that you basically have, I think the college version, which I ended up doing, was 96 hours. So you have 96 hours, you get a problem, and then you have 96 hours to like do some modeling, you know, write your code, and then write a paper about it. So the problem is, if your code is slow, then you know every time you run an experiment, you have to be awake afterwards to look at it.
Yeah.
So I was very unhappy for those 96 hours, just checking my results every couple of hours because uh-huh. the code was so slow. And you know, so that sort of primed me to thinking quality of programming languages, particularly in the scientific space, is a problem that is facing the world. And I, you know, I was thinking about, okay, I'm a fairly decent programmer. Maybe I should get involved in Octave and, you know, fix things. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe a little bit of arrogance. I certainly at the time, you know, I don't think I would have been capable of actually doing much to help without significant guidance. But, you know, I thought I could. But then Julia was announced. And, you know, I said, yes, this, you know, I thought to myself, yes, this project has the right goals. And so I just got involved. I mean, it's an open source project. Anybody can, you know, show up and do something. And mm-hmm. I was using Windows at the time. The thing didn't work on Windows. So I said, okay, I'll port the thing to Windows. So that's what I did.
Nice. So you were in college during this time?
I was in high school. This was my senior year of high school.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. So you started getting involved starting in high school and you kept on working on it in college too?
Yeah, I worked on it. I worked on it all throughout college. And then the last mm-hmm. year of college, we founded the company. And then, you know, kept working on it with the company after college.
Yeah, that's really amazing how you took like your own problem through your own project and how it was running very slow and you wanted to help a programming language for other users. So I'm curious on what are the major use cases for Julia?
The main application areas are certainly scientific simulation, data analysis, you know, that general space of tasks. So that can mean things like climate change modeling. So mm-hmm. one of the really big groups that are using Julia is a collaboration called CLIMA out of Caltech, the Navy Postgraduate School, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and MIT. And, you know, they're working on sort of the next generation standard climate model. So there's, you know, certain climate models that we have, which is what all of these like predictions of, okay, how much warming can the Earth handle? That's what all of these data points are based on. So sort of the next generation of that this CLIMA collaboration is working on, they're doing in Julia, because Julia is a very good language for simulation. And it's very good language if you need to bring together, you know, climate scientists who know what they want to do and computer scientists who want to do it. Because traditionally, you know, that's exactly where this two language split happened, right? The scientists would like to use the easy to use language, and mm-hmm. you know, the computer people would like to use the fast language because they need to get performance out of the system. So, you know, programming languages are as much like human endeavor as they are a technical endeavor. And this like disconnect between domain scientists and, you know, computer engineers, mm-hmm. It can cause real friction and can limit, you know, the kinds of things you can do when developing these sorts of models. So I like to point to CLIMA. You know, people are doing, I think, relevant to our current situation, mm-hmm. Various sorts of pharmaceutical and drug modeling. Basically anything about the simulation, mm-hmm. macroeconomic modeling, geothermal, battery chemistries, machine learning is a big one, of course. Although machine learning is in of itself, you know, a technique. You know, I always find it funny when people say, okay, machine learning is an application area. It's like, no, you use machine learning to do something. Mm-hmm. But you know, if it involves machine learning, Julia is a good way to go about it because machine learning is easy to do in Julia. And then particularly if you're trying to do machine learning in science, right, then you get the double benefit of, okay, like I have a language that's good for machine learning and I have a language that's good for science. So, you know, you end up with a pretty sweet spot if you try mm-hmm. to do machine learning problems in science.
I read that you were working with the Celeste team, which yeah. was collecting data about the visible universe. Could you tell me more about that as well?
Sure. This was a collaboration between us and Lawrence Berkeley National Lab and MIT. Mm-hmm. And basically what the Celeste project is analyzing astronomical survey data. So there's a class of telescope called survey telescopes that have a wider field of view. And what that means is that they see a larger portion of the sky rather than like really narrowly focusing in on, you know, one particular star or galaxy. So, you know, there's this telescope that this data set that we worked with is from a telescope in New Mexico that's called the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. And, you know, over the course of a decade or so, it, you know, took pictures of the sky every night. And then, you know, over the course of a day of, you know, several years, it did several passes over the whole sky. So what you want to do with all these images is basically generate a catalog of, you know, what kinds of stars and galaxies are out there. Mm-hmm. And the reason you might want to do that is then for follow-up observations. So, you know, say you're an astronomer and, you know, you have some particular theory about, okay, this kind of, you know, this kind of star should have, you know, this kind of property. So then you want to, with, you know, a non-survey telescope, a telescope that actually looks closer, you might want to look at all the particular stars that have some color, or, you know, all the particular stars that are in some neighborhood or something. I'm not an astronomer, but, you know, that's how it was explained to me. Uh-huh. So what we did is basically the computation to generate this catalog, but it's a hugely computationally intensive task because, you know, it's basically, you know, almost a decade of, you know, every night taking very high resolution images of the night sky. So, mm-hmm. you know, it was, I think about 50, 60 terabytes of data wow. that we had to process. So we ran this on a supercomputer called Cori, which was at the time the fifth largest supercomputer. I think now it's further down the line at maybe 15 or so. Mm-hmm. But yeah, basically a really large scale statistical inference problem where it would generate this catalog that people could then use for these follow-up observations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems like a whole lot of data. But I guess that also goes along with how fast Julia might be for this particular problem, so it doesn't take like eternity to run.
Oh yeah, I mean, we were definitely limited by the machine. At this point. And basically, people don't want to let you run on supercomputers if you're using a slow language, because these machines cost, you know, millions of dollars to run. And if you only, you know, if you use a language that is 100 times slower, you know, you're basically wasting, you know, 99% of millions of dollars, which is still millions of dollars. And people don't like it yeah. if you waste millions of dollars, right? Like it's much cheaper to tell somebody, hey, you know, with the millions of dollars you would have wasted, go hire somebody to write it in a better language. Uh-huh. I like to talk about this like dichotomy between like slow and fast languages. But mm-hmm. once you're in a fast language, you know, there's still a big difference between slow and fast code. And in particular, slow and code fast enough to run on a supercomputer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, details like the particular way that the caches work on the computer and the particular way that memory works and just like access patterns to memory and you know, the exact instructions that are being used when you run things can easily be another factor of like 20 or 30 even within the same programming language. And even if it's the fastest programming language you have, you know, there's easily, you know, orders of magnitude difference between a naive implementation and a fast implementation. But, you know, it's not magic. You have to work for it.
Yeah, for sure.
But at least it's possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I know you mentioned a few times how you really want to create a language that's like order of magnitude faster or can run orders of magnitude faster is really important. So what actually goes into the creation of a coding language?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's sort of a weird kind of question, right? Because, you know, what is it, you know, what is a programming language, right? I mean, in some respect, it's you know, an abstract thing, like some sort of rules for, okay, these words in a file mean that the computer should do these things, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, you could say, okay, all you have to do to create a programming language is, you know, open a Google Doc and say, okay, in my programming language, when I see the word, you know, hello, the computer should, you know, say hello. That's a programming language, you know, it's a silly one. Uh-huh. And if, you know, the only thing that's legal to do in your programming language is to say hello, then, you know, people might not use it because they can't for anything other than saying hello. But to some respect, in some respect, that's a programming language, right? So how do you create a programming language? Well, you write down, like, this is my programming language, and voila, you're done. Obviously, that's not very satisfying. So, you know, the thing that people most often think of as creating a programming language is to then create a program that does something with the programming language. So, you know, most of the time that's running it. So, you know, if you have these instructions and you know this thing should do that, then, you know, you write a program that reads in the file that says what it should do, and then that does the thing that it said it should have done, right? But that's not always what people want to do. So some programming languages just get created to, like, assert, like, there's a class of programming language called proof assistants. And basically what proof assistants are is they're utilities in helping you prove mathematical theorems. Mm-hmm. And, like, determining the truth or validity, the truth or, you know, non-truth of a particular assertion. And in those languages, often it is the case that, like, the language can only, like, a well-formed program in the language is automatically a true statement. So in that case, the program that people write to implement the language will often be something that checks whether the program is well-formed at all. So they never actually run it. They just check whether the program is, you know, a valid program in the language, because being a valid program in the language implies the truth of some mathematical statement. So, you know, just a fun side note. Generally, when people say create a programming language, they mean, you know, create a program in some other programming language that, you know, then does, you know, takes in some, you know, source text and does the thing that the source text says. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's various fun subtleties involved.
I think it's really interesting how you can go from just like you mentioned, mapping one word to, like, a certain thing that a computer does, and then having a very complex coding language that has a lot more than that. So I think we might have time for one quick last question. What are some major problems you think we have today that Julia might be used for?
That's a good question. So I think the first order question is always, like, will this programming language survive at all, right? Because there's, you know, probably thousands of programming languages that people have created, but maybe, you know, two or three dozen that are actually, like, in use and have stuck around for decades. Because I think, you know, once there's lots of programs written in a language, you know, you kind of need to make sure the language sticks around. I mean, you know, it's been in the news how, like, all of these, you know, states in the U.S. have unemployment systems written in COBOL, which was a popular programming language in, like, the 60s and 70s. And, you know, that language still needs to be around, even though nobody writes it, programs in it anymore, because, you know, we have programs written in them. So, you know, there's sort of this, like, dichotomy of languages between, like, languages that need to stick around because there's important things written in them, and languages that don't. So I think the zeroth order question is, like, has Julia reached that level yet? Or if not, when will it? Mm-hmm. And I think we're just about getting there. You know, I won't say yet, you know, it's guaranteed that, like, nothing could ever happen to it. You know, if all the code got deleted right now and everybody got hit by a bus,
oh no,
you know, maybe people would rewrite it. But, like, I think we get it. Like, if we haven't gotten to that point, I think we're very close to crossing it. So I think Julia is sort of, you know, as a language, is here to stay. And there are sort of various metrics that rank programming languages by popularity. I think they're all nonsense, but, you know, in like the, you know, with the disclaimer that I think they're nonsense, you know, for whatever it's worth, they sort of rank Julia in like the top 20, 25 programming languages by popularity. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, you know, I think top 20-ish is about where I would put that, like, boundary between, like, will go away if people start working on it, and, like, important enough that people will make it not go away because mm-hmm. of its importance in the larger industry. So I think that's been achieved. So, you know, we're stuck with this for the rest of the century. Right? Like, every single mistake I've made the past 8 years, like,
you know,
y'all are stuck with. But so we, I think, as the people behind the language, really want to make sure that it lives up to its potential of like being a tool in solving the toughest challenges that we have, right? So, you know, I mentioned briefly this climate change problem, mm-hmm. And the climate change project to, you know, model climate change. I'm very happy to see that, and I think it's a hugely important thing for people to be able to be able to use these tools to get a better understanding of climate change, and, you know, similar things like, you know, energy and, you know, modeling. I mean, even things like, you know, modeling heating systems to make sure buildings use less energy, or again, climate change related, you know, battery chemistries for, you know, electric vehicles, mm-hmm. You know, all of these like hugely important, you know, on sort of a grand scale challenges, and, you know, disease modeling and drug discovery and all of that, I would say has, you know, gone to the top of my mind given the current situation.
Definitely a very grand goal.
You know, you gotta be a little bit crazy to create a programming language, and we are just now, like, as I said, just now getting to the point where it's actually a real thing, uh-huh. right? Like a real mature programming language. So if you want to create a programming language, you know, you're basically in for like a decade of work, mm-hmm. where it's like not a useful thing yet.
Startups,
like, no VC will give you money if you say, okay, I'm going to do a thing for 10 years.
Uh-huh.
And then, right, because like in 10 years, they want to either have $1 billion or have you failed, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, 10 years is too long a time horizon. So it's another thing about the funding, right? Like,
uh-huh.
there won't be a startup that creates a programming language as sort of, you know, the thing, you know. Maybe a startup does sort of a programming language as a side project. But, you know, if you want to create, to get back to the point I was making, if you create a programming language, you know, it's going to be a 10-year project. So, uh-huh. A, you better make sure it's worthwhile. And B, you got to be a little bit, like, crazy and have delusions of grandeur to do it.
Yeah, that's really amazing. And I do agree that, like, you definitely have that part where it's, you believe that the craziest things are like achievable, right? Because I think you mentioned in the very beginning of the podcast too, how I think in high school you believed that you could change this like coding language, and you ended up doing that with Julia. So I think that's pretty impressive how you're able to start at such a young age and believe that you're able to do it, and you eventually did.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it took a lot of learning, right? Like, mm-hmm. It's sort of this kind of thing. Like, if you ask me now, you know, you pointed me at like the person I was 10 years ago and asked, like, do you think this person has the skills to create a programming language? I would definitely say the answer is no. Right? Like, right? Because, you know, I've learned over the past 10 years that creating a programming language is really hard. If you think it's fun and, you know, you can just like go for it and experiment. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. you're going to fail, you know, but you're going to learn along the way. Right. And like, you don't have to have all the skills to like get to where you're going when you start. And I certainly didn't, even though, you know, if you had asked me at the time, I probably would have said I do, but you know, for lack of knowledge of what the required skills are. Mm-hmm. But I think that's totally fine. I certainly like to just like take on projects where, which I think are interesting, and I think I'm going to learn a lot, and I think I'm going to have fun doing, even if I like have no idea how to possibly do it. Like I did a project last year in like homomorphic encryption, which is you operate on data that's encrypted. So you take some encrypted data in, you put return some encrypted data, and you do some useful computation in the middle. And I'd learned about it in college. You know, I took one college course, but you know, I'm not an expert. I'm not a cryptographer, right? I know some cryptographers, but I'm not one. But you know, I thought it was fun. I thought it was interesting. You know, I was confident in sort of my ability to learn and to figure it out, and you know, to learn some number theory and to read all the relevant papers. And you know, it went fine. Like, I think I learned some interesting things, and I, you know, I'm happy I did that, even though like at the beginning I had no reason to believe that I should be particularly good at cryptography. So
yeah, I think it's an interesting paradox though. It's like in the beginning you may not have been, I guess, objectively equipped to starting it, but by starting it you became equipped to handle it because you were able to learn so much.
Look, I mean, it's really hard to find people who have, you know, 10 years of experience writing programming languages. But, you know, the only way you get 10 years of experience writing programming languages is to write a programming language. So, you know, somebody got to start. And I'm happy I did it. Like, it's been a lot of fun.
Just do it, right? Just start something.
Yeah, just have fun. Like, you don't have to have all the skills yet. Mm-hmm. People in high school have a lot of time. One sort of, like, key thing I realized is that a lot of like technical areas are pretty shallow. Like even like deeply complicated subjects often can be like figured out in like a couple of weeks to a month of like somebody who's really dedicated in learning about it. And you know, the reason why that doesn't mean that like everybody is automatically an expert in all of these deep subjects, that there's so many of them, and like after college, people don't have a lot of time. But like in high school, I had tons of time, right? Like I had nothing to do. Like, you know, I could spend a bunch of time just like figuring things out and failing a lot, right? And like learning by failing. So I think that's a good message. Like, you know, if you're dedicated and, you know, you have some time, I think there's very little that you cannot learn. Just by trying it.
Yeah, I definitely agree that that's a very good message. So number one, just learn and fail and have fun. And number two, high school is a very good time to do it. So yeah, I think that was a great end to the podcast. And thank you so much, Mr. Fisher, for coming on. I definitely, for one, learned a lot and really enjoyed this as well.
Yeah, this was fun. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, of course. And for any of you who enjoyed this podcast, you can see the summary below to find the newsletter, the summary notes. All right, thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you guys next time.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Elevate the Future podcast. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.